November exited New York with a string of cold days and even some snow on the ground, serving as a reminder that winter is coming, if not here already, and therefore the state's energy demands will be increasing. But New Yorkers should have plenty of power to meet their needs, according to the New York Independent System Operator, which recently released a report on the power resources that will be available this winter. To discuss the state's power needs over the next few months, as well as the longer-term challenges and opportunities facing the electricity supplies in New York, we're checking in with Rich Dewey, President and CEO of the New York Independent System Operator, a.k.a. NYISO, for the rest of this interview. Welcome back to the show, Rich.
Pleasure to be back. Good to be in person again.
And, it's exciting.
Great to see you. Yeah.
Yes. So how are the state's electricity needs expected to increase this winter, and how does that compare to the power output we have access to or expect to have access to in New York this winter?
So we're still a summer peaking system, mm-hmm. so we generally have plentiful resources available for the winter. However, you know, this winter is the first winter without both of the Indian Point nuclear units. So we always analyze where the needs are, where the growing capacity demands are, and make sure we've got enough capacity to meet those needs. And we still feel like we've got a sufficient surplus for the winter. The challenges in the winter sometimes are finding fuel. So a lot of the units in New York City that are so critical for reliability are on the local gas network.
Okay.
And during periods of very high demand, gas priority goes to home heating, as it should. And sometimes those units don't have gas availability. So we look at different scenarios, stressing it to try to anticipate which units may or may not be able to get fuel. But even with those constraints, we feel we've got adequate supplies ready for this winter.
In terms of the different scenarios that you play out, how does, say, an ordinary winter that you might be projecting compare to, say, an extreme winter weather scenario for New York?
So with all of the events that happened in Texas last year, there's increasing interest in looking at those very severe weather events. You know, that was a 1-in-100-year cold snap that they experienced down in Texas. And we tried to simulate and project what would New York's resources look like if we had similar very extreme weather conditions for a very long period of time. And we were still pretty satisfied that even with the potential that some of those units wouldn't have enough fuel to be able to get through the entirety of it, that we've still got enough resources to be able to support the system and support the demand in New York. As we look forward into the future, we become increasingly concerned because with the retirement and the anticipated retirement of the gas peaker units, for example, in New York City to comply with some of the new DEC emission standards, we're trying to look out 3 years, 5 years, 10 years to make sure that we understand exactly what the prognosis is for the power system in those forward-looking years. So at this point, we still feel like we've got an adequate surplus in New York. When you start looking at some of the responses we expect to see with compliance with the CLCPA, the climate legislation that was passed in New York a couple of years ago, when you start thinking about the electrification of heating and the electrification of transportation, one of the things that we have our eyes on is our expectation that New York is going to become a winter peaking system sometime in the next decade or decade and a half. So we've got to make sure that our winter capacity requirements can keep up with the growing demand in the winter. But at this point, we're still pretty confident that we've got a good, stable, reliable system.
So a couple things to unpack there. First, you referenced those peaker plants. These are what, plants that come on just during periods of high demand?
That's right. They're on standby the vast majority of the time, and they're only used when the demand gets very, very high, generally in the summer, because we're still a summer peaking system driven by air conditioning. But when we have those periods of extreme load, it's really important to make sure that we've got enough capacity to do that, and that's where the peakers step in.
And can you explain a little bit more about this transition you're envisioning going from the peaks in the summer to the peaks in the winter? When I hear that, I think immediately, wait, are we going to use less air conditioning in the summer and more heat in the winter? Why is there the switch?
So it's really predominantly driven by heating, mm-hmm. heating of buildings and the electrification of the transportation sector. The summer peaks are not going to rise significantly or shrink significantly. It's going to be essentially a flat system in the summer. And what's going to happen is what we're going to see is the demand in the winter is going to rise to be able to meet and then ultimately eclipse the demands that we see in the summer.
Rise above what we're seeing now, you're saying?
That's right.
Okay.
Yep, that's right. So the winter peak, specifically on those cold days when we're leaning on the electric system to heat buildings, we anticipate will rise. We don't think that will happen until until the late 2030s, based on our load models and our projections. And a lot of that is dependent on how successful we are in accelerating the conversion of the transportation fleet to electric and the conversion of the heating stock to electric.
Well, in addition to changing where we get our energy from, there's also this talk about becoming more energy efficient. But it sounds like you think the power demands are just going to go up and up. Is there any reason to think that some of the demands in the future can be moderated by, say, houses that are easier to heat or easier to cool?
We think it will. And in fact, specifically, you see that effect in the summer today.
Okay.
So the successes that we've had as a state in energy efficiency have driven down the peaks that we see in the summer. And we anticipate the summer's peaks to continue to decline over the next, say, 3 to 5 years. Not a ton, but enough that it's noticeable. It's really just the conversion of those facilities. You know, cars today run on gasoline. Buildings are heated by fossil fuels, natural gas, predominantly. So as you convert those sources of heat and sources of transportation over to electricity, that's where the increased demand will come. I anticipate there'll be aggressive energy efficiency efforts to try to limit that. But it's really going to be an increased demand that's on the electric system per se.
Well, continuing with this line of thought, we have heard from environmentalists on this show about a demand they have for Governor Hochul to basically transition at least 2 million homes into energy-efficient, all-electric homes by 2030. Would that radically change the demands in this landscape that you're envisioning?
Well, the timeline is really important. Mm-hmm. When we start looking at the timeline of how aggressively that can be accomplished, and will the electric system be ready to be able to meet that demand? One of the interesting things in this regard is when you look at the profile of what time of day the consumption is, from a heating standpoint, the load is predominantly an overnight and early morning demand, which is different from where you would see, say, lighting or certainly air conditioning. So the shape of the load curve will be somewhat different. So that will help us get the electric system ready to make sure that we've got the appropriate resources at the appropriate time of day to be able to meet it.
In case you're just joining us, you're listening to the Capitol Press Room, and we're speaking with Rich Dewey, President and CEO of the New York Independent System Operator. So why is it that you're able to say so confidently that we're going to have enough power for the winter? For example, are there state or federal rules that ensure we have capacity, or is this just the good work of people, or did we just get lucky?
So it's less luck. It's more hard work. Mm-hmm. There are standards that the North American Electric Liability Council, which is the enforcement arm of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or the FERC, so there are standards that we need to design and operate the power system to make sure on a day-to-day basis we've got enough capacity available to meet what we expect to be the demand. Some of it is just the profile of the electric system, where the amount of generating resources we have is designed to meet the summer peak, which is much higher than what we anticipate or that we ever see really in the winter. So we've just got more resources available. One of the things that we do as far as a readiness for the winter is making sure that the generating plants are ready for cold weather operation. Some of what you saw down in Texas last winter was those plants are just not designed to run at those low temperatures. So there's steps that the generating plants need to take to make sure that they're ready. The other is access to fuel. So as I indicated, you know, on those super cold days, access to natural gas becomes pretty scarce. And in New York, we have the added, I'll call it belt and suspenders approach, where generating plants that rely on natural gas have to have oil reserves that they can then run in at those time periods that they can't get gas. So it allows us to have additional capabilities when the gas fuel is just not available or gets redirected to the home heating system.
So we're thinking about power needs in terms of supply, but what about the infrastructure to deliver it throughout the winter? What could jeopardize the delivery of power, say, in December, January, February? And do we have safeguards to build against long power outages caused by interruptions in delivery?
Well, we continue to look at the necessary upgrades for the transmission system. You know, when you look at where, you know, as fossil fuel resources get retired and get decommissioned off the system, where's that replacement power coming from? It's coming from renewables. Mm-hmm. And the very aggressive approach that New York State is taking towards renewables, today, most of those resources are upstate. So we need to have the transmission upgrades necessary to move that power to downstate. When we look further into the future, offshore wind holds a tremendous amount of promise, and we have to look at the transmission infrastructure for example, the offshore wind, if it connects into Long Island, how do you get that power from Long Island into the city? So we're mapping out some of the transmission upgrades that are necessary to make sure we can move that power into the load pockets where it's needed on those days.
So you're talking about the future, though. Right now in 2021, 2022, should we feel confident about the transmission infrastructure we have right now?
To meet today's load, yes. I mean, we feel pretty strongly that we can meet those demands, and that the system, if every facility is operating up to the expectations, we project that we're going to have no issues for at least the next few years. It's when those peaker plants and some of those fossil fuel plants that are nearing retirement start to drop off the system. That's when we've got to ensure that we've got sufficient power coming in to be able to replace that in order to meet the demand. And we look out 10 years or more. I mean, every year we do a 10-year study. In this past year, we did a 20-year study looking out to 2040. It's going to be such a radical change to our power system to have a carbon-free electric system by 2040, as the CLCPA dictates. So we've done some pretty aggressive modeling to try to understand what needs are going to need to be in place, because it takes a long time to build it.
But what about just a bad storm? Is that something that knocks out power to just a small area, or can a big amount of snow, wind, whatever, have significant ramifications for large portions of the state and for an extended period of time?
Well, certainly the distribution system is more vulnerable to storm-related power outages. Mm-hmm. A lot of the lines, you know, you see coming down our street to our houses are above ground. There's a lot of trees. So when you start thinking about snow and wind and icing events, that's just much more susceptible to power outages. The bulk system in New York is highly reliable, and that's what we're responsible for at the NYISO. So we look at it from a bulk system readiness standpoint. But still, that could be susceptible to icing or other types of severe storms. Some of the new transmission work that's underway right now across the Mohawk River Valley and down the Hudson River Valley to New York City, part of the AC transmission system, is the construction that's underway there, are looking at strengthening bolstered resiliency measures to make sure that those towers are stronger than the ones that they're replacing, and they can withstand more icing and more wind. So we're thinking forward to some of those more severe weather events and the severe storms brought on by climate change, and how do we make sure that the power system is going to be as resilient as it can. And, you know, those are the things that we put in all our design efforts.
So while we're going to have power this winter to heat our homes and turn on the exterior lighting decorations for the people who do that kind of thing, many New Yorkers have been warned that the cost of their electricity is going to be much more expensive this year. Is this a product of just the inflation we're seeing across the economy, or is this something else?
To some extent, it goes with the ebbs and flows of the cost of petroleum and the cost of natural gas.
Okay.
The electric system and the prices that you see in the wholesale electric system are largely driven by natural gas prices. And we're seeing a higher projected price of natural gas. Some of it has to do with the amount that's stored in some of the underground caverns and storage facilities. There's just less of it. I think that the industry has stockpiled in advance of the winter. One of the things to keep in mind is the last several years we saw historically low natural gas prices. A lot of it was driven by the shale gas revolution and the access to more gas and cheaper gas. So we've seen some of the electricity prices, you know, really over the last 4 or 5 years come down significantly. And I think some of this is probably a moderating of that. And some of it is, you know, in recognition that there's a lot of pressure on the fossil fuel industry to produce less, generally to use less. And some of this, I just think, is the market economics of seeing some of those measures take shape.
Well, thinking about market economics, if cost is up, is there a chance that demand then could go down and then the cost could follow and we might not go through the entire winter with high energy costs?
It could. It could. I mean, a lot of it is weather dependent. And if we get those super cold peaks that make natural gas demand so incredibly high that the price goes up, and if we never see those weather patterns, that could be true. But there are customers that actually moderate their consumption based on the price. They're responsive to what the mm-hmm. price is, and they can make business decisions to curtail their consumption, and that reduction in demand then moderates prices as well.
And after a quick break, we'll continue our conversation with Rich Dewey, President and CEO of the New York Independent System Operator.
Support for the Capitol Press Room is provided by New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals in education, human services, and healthcare.
We're continuing our conversation about the state's ability to meet the power demands of New Yorkers this winter, and our guest is Rich Dewey, President and CEO of the New York Independent System Operator. So, sticking with another angle of preparedness, when you and I spoke in the early days of the pandemic, we talked about the really extreme isolation policies you were engaged in to ensure you had healthy staff to monitor the distribution of power. You've relaxed some of these sequestration safeguards, but what are you doing still to ensure that you're not going to have a large number of your staff succumb to COVID infections, whether serious or not, but making them unable to come to work?
You know, in the early days of the pandemic, we really didn't know what it was going to take to keep everybody safe and healthy. So we did make the dramatic decision to have our power system operators move into trailers on our facility just to make sure we could protect them and isolate them. We've learned a lot more about what it takes in terms of, you know, wearing masks. Obviously, vaccines are a gigantic piece of that safety measure, that protection measure. We have taken the step at the New York ISO to mandate all employees, visitors, and meeting attendees need to demonstrate that they're fully vaccinated. So that way we can keep the office facilities as safe as possible for the employees that are living in, you know, that are working there.
How's that going? Did employees embrace that?
Very well. It wasn't 100%, but we got a very, very high voluntary vaccination rate. It was in the mid-90s. NYSO employees understand what it takes to run the power system, the risk associated with the health impacts of the pandemic, and I was very, very pleased with the response that we got from the employees. So far, we haven't had any serious significant issues. We continue to look and follow, you know, the advice and the guidance of the government, whether it's New York State Department of Health or the CDC. For example, you know, this week we've asked everybody to work from home again this week, even though we've been back in the office, because it's the week following the holiday. And we know that those surges typically take place after the holidays. So we adjust our work schedules based on what we're seeing in the environment and the advice we're getting from the experts.
Anybody ask you just to bring back the trailers just every once in a while? So like, I've had enough of home.
I did get a lot of offers to purchase the trailers around summertime, people that wanted to take them on vacation. But no, I don't think anybody wants to actually move back into them on a regular basis.
In October, the Hochul administration denied a permit for a new natural gas-fired power generation facility in Orange County, as well as a natural gas facility in Queens, with the former promising more than 500 megawatts of generating capacity. How would the addition of these power sources impacted your work if they had been permitted?
I think one of the things to look at is when you're assessing your readiness to meet the demands of the power system, you look at the amount of capacity that you have. We anticipate at any given day, you know, we could have failure of power systems, whether it's mechanical failures or access to fuel. We always have our eye on the amount of capacity needed to meet the projected demand. Mm-hmm. We've enjoyed a surplus in New York, quite honestly, for the last 10 years or so, where we've had a capacity above and beyond what was absolutely necessary. With the retirements of Indian Point and the planned retirements of the peaker systems down in New York City in 2023 and 2025, we're very, very concerned that that capacity margin is shrinking. The plants that were proposed were not needed to meet reliability, the base reliability criteria.
But not needed now, or not needed, aren't needed in the future?
Not needed by our projections for the next 10 years.
Okay.
But that's just to meet the bare minimum criteria. You know, one of the things that we have to keep our eyes on is if the demand for home heating electrification or the rate and the pace of the transportation electrification goes faster than we project, then we're going to need more capacity faster than we think. So one of the things we keep our eyes on is how close to that reliability margin are we? And our most recent 10-year planning study indicates that we are very, very close to that capacity margin between now and 2030, which is the period of time that we look at. So it's not a concern from a base reliability standpoint. It having more capacity gives us more assurance that if we have failures of other plants, you know, that we're not going to have a significant problem. What it really points to, I think, is the absolute importance and necessity of some of these clean energy targets to actually hit their implementation dates. So offshore wind, you know, they've got specific dates by which they want to integrate those projects. Some of the new NYSERDA Tier 4 projects, which are proposed to bring baseload power down from Canada, you know, hitting those dates for implementation will certainly relieve some of the concerns that we have with reliability margins, but it's just going to be critical that we hit those dates.
So are there indicators that we actually will hit these dates? You know, putting aside just the fact that we have these goals, when you look at the landscape, does it seem like there are concrete, quantifiable steps being taken to ensure that we don't have the capacity issues that you're saying are a potential?
We monitor their schedules to make sure they're making forward progress on some of their interim, whether it's design milestones. We'll certainly feel a lot better when the construction actually starts, and then that will give us something to monitor and track and get better assurances. So right now, it seems to have absolutely has the right kind of priority. And clearly the focus is there on the part of the state agencies that are recognize how important that is. So we work with them on a very regular basis. You know, if it looks like these projects aren't going to hit the milestones that we're planning for, and it looks like we're going to have some capacity issues, then, you know, then there's probably going to be additional measures we're going to have to take. But at least as we sit here today, we're pretty confident that we can run a reliable power system for the foreseeable future.
Well, because it takes time to build up capacity, is it the case that if things don't go as expected, that the state may not have time to respond appropriately if things don't go as expected?
It's certainly possible. You know, it's certainly possible. And then there's going to be measures we have to look at, whether they're, you know, emergency measures to bring power in from somewhere else, or, you know, if there's facilities we can bring online quickly. You know, things like storage can be brought online very quickly. It's just a matter of the investment to make it happen. We're focusing hard on the transmission infrastructure build out that we think is going to be important. We're working very closely with NYSERDA and the progress that their projects are making, and we're very, very pleased with those efforts. And it's just going to be a continuous monitoring and study proposition from now until this power system transitions. It's exciting. I mean, it's never been more exciting in the electric space as it is in New York right now. And it's just going to require us to continue to keep our eyes on it.
Your energy is palpable, Rich. It's infecting me right now. But finally, for years now, NYSO has been beating the drum for incorporating the social cost of CO2 emissions into the wholesale energy markets, a carbon pricing plan in order to incentivize a reduction in emissions from fossil fuels and encouraging that pivot to greener energies. In the past, when we've talked about this, it seems like you've been focusing on getting the legislature and then the governor to statutorily implement something that would lead the way on this. Is that still how you're approaching this, or is it still the way you have to approach this? And if so, how do you feel heading into 2022 that this is something lawmakers, specifically the Democratic majorities, feel about potentially taking on?
Well, we still believe strongly in market forces and market economics as a means to, in the most efficient manner, you know, drive the kind of response that you want. So we still feel that putting a price on carbon, whether it's in the electric system or whether it's in the, you know, economy-wide price in general, which might drive more behaviors in a much faster way, it will yield the most timely and efficient transition of the economy, of the system, you know, of all these sectors that we want to drive the carbon emissions out of. Right now, we're making really good progress with the systems that are in place. You know, we stand at the ready
to implement or introduce this social cost of carbon into the electric system when and if New York State determines that this is a means and a tool that we want to use, a lever, another additional lever to help drive the kind of development response that we need to see in order to bring these resources in. New York State has not yet gotten to that point that they feel that that's a necessary step or that's an important step. And, you know, we continue to look at it. And, you know, if and when the time is right, that's something that certainly we could easily do in the electric system for New York.
When you say it seems like the state doesn't feel like it's the right now, are you talking about like the legislature? Are you talking about the Climate Action Council?
No, I think when you look at, you know, this is an economy-wide approach. I focus on the electric system because that's where my life is. But when you start thinking about what the real end goal of the CLCPA is, it's reduce emissions out of the electric system for sure. But it's also, you know, when you think about the electric system, the building sector, and the transportation system, the electric system actually emits less carbon than those other two.
Right.
Right. So when you start thinking about what the real end goal is, it's that 2050, you know, carbon neutral economy. And you need to do all three of those, not just the electric system, which carbon pricing would do, we think, more quickly than some of the mechanisms that are in place. But it's the transportation sector and the building sector. So I think that there is the desire to have eyes wide open about what the cost impact of all of these things are. And we just need to do a little bit more study at that, just considering what the economic response might be to New Yorkers.
Well, in that landscape of potentially doing a societal cost of carbon across the entire economy, it seems like one of the leading legislative proposals on that front is the Climate and Community Investment Act, something that the Democratic majorities did not move in 2021. Would you like to see them move that in 2022?
I think that that would elicit a more rapid conversion than we probably are braced for today. Mm-hmm. And I think that that would actually get us to that carbon neutral economy faster. And the good news about that is the electric markets, as they're designed and set up in New York, could very easily accommodate that without a lot of rework and still drive a reliable solution for New Yorkers. As a matter of whether it should be adopted, that's a matter of policy. I think that the legislature and state government's got to look at more holistically. So,
but if Rich Dewey was the 64th state senator, would you, or would you be a nay, or would you be one of those without recommendation guys in committee?
Climate change is a significant problem, and if we're going to attack it aggressively, we need to use every tool that we have in the toolkit. And I've said that a number of times, and that's a very powerful tool. So I think it's something that we got to seriously look at.
Well, we've been speaking with Rich Dewey. He is the president and CEO of the New York Independent System Operator, aka NYISO. Rich, thank you so much for making the time and for visiting us in person at the Capitol.
Yeah, thanks, David. It's great to be back in the halls of the Capitol again.
Support for the Capitol Press Room is provided by Destiny USA. Shopping, dining, and entertainment all in one location. For more information, go to www.destinyusa.com.